Dr. Patel, thank you for accepting to talk to us about the importance of nutrition in gastroenterology. Dr. Patel is a gastroenterologist and consultant at St. George's Hospital.
Thank you for this invitation, and I am proud to do this interview today.
Thank you so much. Recent developments in nutritional science demonstrate that the way we eat impacts our gut health. What is your response to these claims, and what have your experiences with patients demonstrated in relation to this statement?
So the way I always look at this, I mean, this is a broad question, but if we just look at what applies to the majority, some things are now definite. The major thing impacting Europe and first world countries is the amount of calories and fat which people are now choosing to put into their intestine. So the whole society has gone to fast food, you know, soft drinks. If you really ask me why I think the soft drink consumption is so high, it's because London water is not clean or as tasteful as it could be, and therefore people don't want to buy a drink of water which is a pound when a soft drink is 50p. But putting fat, putting calories and putting sugar is probably the highest risk intervention people are self-doing without realizing in the community. And what we now see is that 30 to 40% of young adults are obese. So on simple metrics, 30 to 40% of adults are obese. The other thing of eating foods like that means you don't eat healthy food. Because if you fill yourself up with a soft drink and a McDonald's or any fast food, then where are you getting your five vegetables, your greens, your fresh fruit? And really, that has a negative impact on every system. So being overweight before was just called obese.
Yes.
Now we call it a metabolic syndrome because it impacts nearly every organ. So, you know, you wouldn't think, does it impact your eyes? Well, like, actually, if you're getting overweight, your risk of cataract goes up.
Wow.
Yeah. The sugar has a direct impact on teeth. So non-obvious links which people don't realize. And breathing, yes, if you're overweight, you struggle to breathe properly because you're struggling to carry yourself. The heart, we all know. The stroke risk, we all know. But liver failure in the next 10 years, the number one cause will be fatty liver disease. And not alcohol and hepatitis B, hepatitis C, which historically were the highest causes of liver failure. The liver, nobody thought. Pancreas, diabetes is caused by being overweight as a major risk factor. Kidneys as well. So it impacts everybody. Bones, musculoskeletal system, we forget that. Yeah. Do we see that in patients? I see that in my clinics all the time. I don't think society is willing to accept that. A lot of people say to me, I can't lose weight. Why is that happening? And it's very difficult to sometimes say in a political way, it's because you're putting in too many calories. But there's very few conditions where you put on weight without eating. There are a few rare ones, but the majority of conditions are directly related to how many calories go in and how much you burn. So if you're burning a lot, you can afford to eat more. But if you're not burning a lot, then you have to change your diet. With each decade of age, we actually need less and less calories, and people aren't aware of that. So if you go back 150 years, most jobs were very active up to the age of 60. So it wasn't, again, as obvious as it is today. But if you think England was 150 years ago a labour country, you could actually eat more because you're burning it in your day-to-day life. In my job, I probably do 10,000 footsteps a day, but most jobs these days will not hit 10,000 footsteps a day. So we're not most office-based jobs in the city. So for example, a lot of people I did university with who work in the city hardly do any walking. So calories, fat, sugar is the first thing I would like to highlight. Then the next two harms are probably alcohol and smoking. Now, I don't know whether we count those as nutrients or not, but there is excessive alcohol intake in a large volume of young adults in this country, and also smoking. And again, it impacts multiple organs. Fiber and fruit and vegetable are probably not consumed at the target the body needs. Most people, when they come to my clinic, when they have a GI complaint related to a lack of fiber, I ask them, how much fiber do you think you should be eating? And nobody knows. Yeah, it's between 20 and 30 grams. As a rough figure, it's 25 grams. Ironically, all of the information is on the internet, but I think, you know, sometimes you choose not to read those things. And that's probably the major nutrition impacts on a day-to-day basis. Now, the other, we all know about the heart risk and the stroke risk, but we sometimes forget cancer is now also directly related to a lot of foods. So smoking and cancer risk has been known since many, many years. Alcohol is now implicated in numerous cancers. Mouth cancers, esophagus cancers, just to name a few. There is now some evidence showing a lack of fiber might be linked to bowel cancer. processed red meats are linked to bowel cancer. You know, alcohol is now also being possibly linked to bowel cancer. So these are the rare things which sometimes get forgotten. It's hard to be healthy. It's hard to eat a healthy diet. It takes a lot of effort, partly because if you have 15 minutes for lunch, how can you find fresh food? If you go to the standard shop and if you look at the fruit and veg and the fresh price, and if you look at something processed, it is highly prohibitive, where the ready-made sandwich is a lot cheaper than a healthy-looking salad. But you know, these are not things which are easy to rectify easily, because the shops want to make money and they have priced their things accordingly. Yeah, but that's what I try to tell a lot of my patients, that it's easy to be unhealthy. If you want to be healthy in today's day and age, you have to go and get yourself a, like, an online food diary, and which works out how much you're eating, so you can then highlight what's missing. A lot of these apps will have built-in readouts, so it will tell you, this is how much protein you've had today, this is how much carbohydrate you've had, this is how much fiber you've had, as long as you put in correctly what you're eating at the approximate weight, and then you can work out what you're not having enough of, and then you take it from there. And then obviously diet and exercise should go hand in hand, so the complete package is eating healthily and doing enough exercise.
Excellent, thank you. As we briefly discussed, a particular nutrient which is promoted for its benefits to gut health is fiber. Are there any other details you think would be useful to know about the relationship between fiber and gut health?
Fiber has numerous impact in gut health. There's short-term and long-term. So if we look at short-term first, if you're not eating enough fiber on a day-to-day basis, and it's 20 to 30 grams, the chances are you will be prone to constipation. And that's the short-term impact. Now, it doesn't happen to everyone, because for other reasons, your gut might be moving rapidly. So therefore, if you are somebody who has a fast-moving gut, you may not notice you're getting constipated. But the first effect is constipation. The knock-on effect of constipation is then you sit on the toilet and you have to strain. Okay, and then when you strain, you get other problems like hemorrhoids and skin tags. So then it becomes a cosmetic issue. Okay, and those are probably the two most immediate impact of not having enough fiber. Then in terms of long-term impact, that's where this cancer risk is now postulated, that if you don't have enough fiber, then you're possibly predisposing yourself to colorectal cancer, not any of the other cancers. But the more common problem, which about 50% of people have after the age of 50, is this condition called diverticulosis. Now that is when the muscles in the bowel have got weak. That's the simplest way of me explaining that condition. Fiber is the substrate for exercise for the bowel. So it bulks up the stool, and it means the bowel is then contracting properly to push it along. And that exercise the bowel needs. And if you're not having enough fiber, that contraction is not as optimal as it could be, and the muscles start going weak. And the initial thing which we see, and we see this a lot when we do lower intestine endoscopy, is called these pouches, which we call diverticuli. And then they can get inflamed and they can bleed. So when they get inflamed, they can bleed and they can get infected, sorry. So two things can happen. So those are the knock-on effects. But those are long-term complications. So young people won't realize that until they cross at least into the second half of life. It's difficult, again, the problem with fiber is it can also cause bloating. So people eat fiber and they feel very full. And with modern society, everybody wants to wear tight clothes, you know, tight-fitting suits. And that's one of the other reasons why people are slightly against eating fiber. But that's a small, it has a lot of benefits.
So would you say that it's advisable to provide patients with guidance about diet and nutrition?
So my answer would of course be biased, because my research is in nutritional optimization of the area I'm a specialist in, which is Crohn's disease. But the answer to that is definitely yes. And on every ward now, we have a nutrition team. So we have dietitians available. Of course, the problem is we cannot have a dietitian for every patient in a hospital bed, and we cannot have a dietitian for every patient who goes to the GP. We have screening tools where we try to highlight the ones who are underweight, but the bigger problem in UK is not being underweight, is being overweight. So the overweight ones are probably not screened as well as they should, because a lot of people become massively overweight before they get to a clinic. The underweight ones, I think we're quite good at picking up, and we start supplementing those. And definitely, whatever you want to do, if somebody is not in a good nutrition state, you're increasing their complications. So I'll give you an example. I deal with patients who have Crohn's disease. Sometimes they need an operation to take out a bit of intestine which has gone bad. If we do that when they're malnourished, the complications are 2-3 times higher than if they're in a reasonable nutritional state. At St. George's, we do try to make sure that every patient who's in a hospital bed has a nutrition assessment. okay? And then if that nutrition assessment highlights them as someone who's at risk, they get seen by a dietitian. We also make sure that everybody is getting appropriate calories while they're in hospital, and sometimes that needs an artificial way of feeding. In the clinics, we like to be proactive to try to highlight the ones who need to see a dietitian. So the ones I know which we're very good at are the patients who are having irritable bowel syndrome, for example, which can be caused by certain food types. So those patients always are offered a dietitian appointment as first-line treatment. And the ones who then are malnourished get seen as well. We have an obesity service in this hospital. Obesity services probably need more money than they have available from a government point. And we have criteria for the ones who are at highest risk, and they get offered to be seen in the obesity clinic as well. Yeah.
So you say that not everyone can be seen by a dietitian or a nutritionist.
Yeah.
So do you feel that it would be useful for people to have more resources available to them to advise them about their nutritional health?
It's very difficult to answer that question with a scientific basis because, for example, you know, if you just look at the three of us in this room today, to the eye, none of us look malnourished or overnourished. So is there then a benefit of a dietitian seeing us? Probably not. And you know, if we had unlimited resources in an ideal world, it would be good for a dietitian to see everyone. But we don't have unlimited resources. England is one of few countries which offers an NHS, and for an NHS to survive, we have to be cost effective. So at the current standpoint, where on a ward which has 24 patients, we have one dietitian cannot see 24 patients even in a week. So they have to highlight the 6 to 8 who need to be seen every day, who have the most to gain from the intervention. And that's how the system works at the moment. Yeah, it would be an interesting question to see whether everybody would gain from it. You would have to do a study where one ward everybody got it and on another ward everyone didn't get it, and then you would know. We do have very good screening tools to highlight people who are at risk. So the screening tools looks at how much food goes in, looks at their general weight. You know, there are some other tests we use, and blood tests as well. So all of those patients always get seen.
I meant more in terms of the patients taking responsibility for their nutritional health.
Yeah. I mean, I think that should be taught as a module in school. Once you're in a hospital bed, you've missed the window. Yep. So, you know, I always, when I reflect at the age of 40 now, I'm turning 40 in 2 months, at what my son's learning in school and what I learnt in school. And I think there's so many simple things schools are missing. So, you know, the role of we mentioned smoking, alcohol and food, there should be a whole module on that throughout school. Because if you have young, fit people, then it transmits into young adult life, which transmits into mid-adult life, and transmits into later life. The life expectancy in England now is over 85. But there is a big difference between an 85-year-old who is mobile and an 85-year-old who cannot walk because their bones and muscles cannot sustain the weight they're carrying in terms of quality of life. And all of these things need to be start being taught from the age of 11. You know, we teach sex education at 11. In school, so how is this any more of a contentious? They might hear things they don't like or seem crude, but I think you need to know that these are the risks of not eating healthy. This is what healthy food is. Yeah. You know, we're not. I don't know about this whole vegan argument going on, but even simple things on if the world went vegan, how much better it could be for the society, in terms of all the pollution and all the animals dying and things, and all of these things I think should be taught at school. And then everyone can make their own decision with all of the information before it's too late.
So what would you usually recommend for patients with gallstones, celiac disease, or acid reflux?
So we'll look at each of those conditions in turn. So gallstones is this condition which, when I was in medical school, we were taught that this is when you see a patient who is fair, who is overweight or fat is the short term for that, fertile, and by that somebody who is at the age they can have kids, in their 40s, they are at risk of gallstone disease. So those are the risk factors. So fair is generally Caucasian, fertile, as I said, overweight is the fat, is the 4 F's, and in their middle age, in the 40s. But we see gallstones in any, even slim people have gallstones, that's a reality. Sometimes when you've lost a lot of weight, you develop gallstones, because if somebody's overweight and they want to underweight, that is a risk factor for gallstones. There is fat in gallstones, and they approximate about 20% of gallstones are what we call fat gallstones. And equally, a lot of people go through their life without knowing they have gallstones, who have been in good health their entire life, and then on a post-mortem we see, oh, they had incidental gallstones. So is there, the dietary role in gallstones is trying not to get overweight, which is definitely a risk factor. Beyond that, fatty foods will then precipitate gallstone attacks if you've developed gallstones, but you've missed your window again. And if that's happening, then you need an operation to remove the gallbladder and remove the gallstones. So there isn't really any dietary intervention which we now routinely use to treat gallstones, because we would just operate. And the operation is now so low risk, it prevents other gallstone-related complications. But I think, you know, that you can protect yourself by not getting overweight. So that's, again, the simple measures. Celiac disease is a condition which is an autoimmune condition which about 1% of the population has, where there is a genuine gluten allergy. So by putting gluten into your body, you're making ulcers in the top half of the small intestine. And if you continue doing that, the ulcers get bigger, and if you continue doing that, then you can't even develop cancers at the ulcer site. And 99% of people will respond to absolute withdrawal of gluten in their diet. So the main foods which have gluten are wheat, rye, and barley, and some oats are made in plants with gluten. So all of those patients will always see a dietitian regularly to make sure they're doing their best to stay away from gluten. And as I said, for 99% of people who have celiac disease, taking away the gluten is the cure. Now, in a week, I will see 3 or 4 people with celiac disease in my clinics. Today I saw one. And then lifelong, we need to keep re-emphasizing that. And then we keep checking that their vitamin D, iron, folic acid, you know, other nutrients are optimal, because when you're withdrawing foods, other things can get forgotten in the diet. Plus, if you have ulcers in the bowel, then other things are not absorbed as well. We do bone scans and we keep an eye on them. But the dietary, you know, the management of celiac in absence of complications is exclusively on diet. Now, in 2019, it is much easier to do that, because any shop you go into, you can see what has gluten in it, what doesn't. In the past, you used to get foods on prescription on celiac, but you don't anymore. Reflux is an interesting one. I mean, reflux is another one which, if you're overweight, unhealthy diet of acid-related foods, you're prone to it. And most people, when they come to my clinic with reflux, we do the simple things. We always do an endoscopy to make sure they don't have any complications of reflux. That test doesn't help their symptoms. It just tells them they don't have ulcers because of excessive acidity. And some people have developed a hiatus hernia, which again is linked to being overweight, which predisposes to reflux. But the treatment, preventative, is to, again, try not to put on weight and to try to ensure there's not too much acid in your food, and not eating after 6 o'clock. Because if you eat after 6 or 7 o'clock and then you go to sleep at 10 o'clock, there can still be food in your stomach when you lay flat, which can then push acid up. Smoking, again, predisposes reflux, and excessive alcohol can predispose to reflux. So lifestyle has overall a big component in reflux. Generally, again, most patients would prefer a tablet than work on the lifestyle, and a lot of people want operations for their reflux. But if you are overweight and you have reflux, losing weight is very effective treatment. Losing weight is not easy. So that's the dilemma. It is a condition which can happen in essence to anyone, but there is it is linked with being overweight, and it is linked with certain foods for sure. Yes. So in terms of which food for the three illnesses to avoid,
yep,
or make more use of. So in gallstones, as I said, you basically want to just try to stay between a BMI, the body mass index, of 20 to 25, and then they say fatty foods predispose to an attack when you've had it. Only a patient who has it would know if that's true or not. But that is the general advice we give. For celiac disease, as we already mentioned, is absolute gluten avoidance. And for acid reflux, it's basically not eating after 6 o'clock and avoiding acidic foods. But the truth for all three of those conditions is you want protein intake of 30 to 35% of your total consumption, then carbohydrate to be similar, and then the rest of it, the other foods. And the general advice for healthy eating apply to pretty much every condition. So what you should take in is virtually the same for every condition. Okay, in celiac disease you can't eat gluten, but otherwise the general healthy eating is the same. Yeah.
So could you outline for me the most concerning gastrointestinal disease you encounter day to day? And do you think that this disease is preventable?
So I'm one of the Crohn's doctor specialists for this hospital. Ulcerative colitis, that's my main area of interest. So we'll talk about Crohn's disease. because that's probably the condition I see most in my clinics now. So Crohn's disease is a condition where you can get inflammation anywhere really in the body, but the intestine is obviously the most documented complications of it, where you can get ulcers anywhere from the mouth to the back passage, and the complications can be quite devastating. So people can develop holes in the bowel which communicate with other organs in the bowel, that's called fistula. You can have a frank perforation of the bowel, you can have a narrowing of the bowel which causes profuse vomiting, a lot of patients are underweight, and what precisely causes it we don't know. Okay, there's an autoimmune component, and most of our treatments target the autoimmune system. It is there within 10% of families. There is a bit of a family clustering, so there is a genetic predisposition. There's things in the environment which switch the Crohn's disease on in certain individuals. Smoking is one of them, but still the majority of people who have Crohn's disease do not smoke. And there are certain infections which again switch the Crohn's disease on. Is it preventable? I don't think so, because a lot of people don't have an obvious risk factor and still get it. And it's on the increase, it's not on the decrease. And despite us living to a longer age, we are picking up more people with this condition. Maybe in the future we might find the precise things which cause it, which then mean we could make it preventable. But management of it is very interesting, because in children we will start almost exclusively first with the diet management. But it's not a diet which is easy to take. You have to go on a liquid protein diet for Crohn's disease. And while you're on the liquid protein diet, that's almost as effective as any other medical treatment we have, like steroids and immunosuppressive drugs. And the liquid diet has no side effects, except can you sustain not eating any solid food and not what you like for an indefinite period. And if you can do that, then it's very effective. What we do in this hospital is we offer it to everyone instead of steroids, which is the frontline treatment for Crohn's disease. And about 20 to 25% of people will say to me they think they can do it. So those will always go exclusively on a liquid. And I just saw a young man in clinic today who's been doing it for 8 weeks, and he says he feels back to normal. Now he actually says he's running like he used to run 15 years ago. He's got so much energy from it. You take 2,000-3,000 calories of this liquid diet, and it sort of suppresses the inflammation in the intestine. We give it to everybody before an operation, because before an operation we want to condition people so we get the right, it's got a good concentration of protein and carbohydrate automatically in that feed. So by having that feed, you get all of your nutrients and you just drink it like a milkshake. And what we're finding is that if we do that for everyone before an operation, then less people are having complications after the operation. So in that situation, I will almost enforce it on patients in their best interest, at least to give it a try. And if after a week they say, I can't do this, then we accept it. But I say to them that you've got so much to gain from this, why don't you give it a go? And for that, we've got a dedicated clinic where myself, the surgeon and the dietitian, all three of us talk to the patient together to say why it's worthwhile. Instead of steroids is a very difficult one, because when you're not going to operate on someone and you know someone's going to need Crohn's disease treatment for a long period, it's difficult to ask someone not to eat for more than 2-3 months anything solid. So every year we'll have a handful of patients who do it for 6 to 12 months because they don't want to take steroids and they want to give it a go. But the majority of adults cannot do that. In our pediatric side, and I don't treat kids, but there are children who will have been on this sort of treatment for 6 months to 2 years, the sicker ones,
okay,
for Crohn's disease. That's how we use diet to treat it. Preventable, nothing at the moment suggests it's preventable, if you want me to be honest. When we can gene map and we can alter genes, it might be preventable, but not at the moment.
Do you believe that controlling one's diet and other lifestyle factors could increase the effectiveness of your treatments of the aforementioned disease? If so, what would you recommend and why?
If we just look at general principles, I'm a physician, but sometimes I will have to send a patient for an operation. Now, let's not look at the extremists of when they need an operation. If you're eating healthy, you're boosting your immune system. So if you're eating the right amount of protein and carbohydrate and vitamins and minerals, then you're boosting your own immune system. Yeah. And for example, if we look at athletes, they would never go and compete if they haven't been eating the right food. So in any illness, in the same way, if you're not putting the right things in and your body is not at its optimum, your own immune system is not fighting the condition as well as it can. Also, if you're eating an excessive sugar and you're running your sugars higher, again, complications to every condition is generally increased. So therefore, in a lot of chronic conditions, you have to address lifestyle and you have to address diet. And that includes smoking and alcohol, you know, that gets forgotten, and that includes exercise. And if you look at the top five chronic conditions, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, kidney problems, and heart problem, whichever five you want to look at it, that's correct. Cancer, which is on the other extremists, the links of smoking are definitely there, and the links of obesity are there as well. Lifestyle is an important management of every chronic condition and should be the starting point. It's not as easy to always implement. It takes a lot of discipline from the patient to do it properly. And that's why I think it probably gets a little bit forgotten, because we do now have a lot of tablets which will bypass the need for lifestyle changes, but that this shouldn't be the approach we take. We've spoken about Crohn's disease. And in Crohn's disease, you know, my own research, we were offering everybody who was needing an operation, which is the end stage complication, a liquid diet for somewhere between 6 weeks and 12 weeks before the operation was due. And we were doing that on a case-by-case basis. So some people would only need 6 weeks, some people would need a bit longer. And what we were actually seeing was their symptoms were getting under control while they were on the liquid diet. The recovery from the operation was half for the group who took the liquid diet than the group who didn't, to focus on diet, and less people were needing stomas. So there was massive wins there. You know, before anybody goes to a cancer, we want to make sure they're in a reasonable nutrition state. So most cancer patients will see a dedicated dietitian, and a feeding tube sometimes is put in to assist them because they can't always eat. And same for before chemotherapy, you know, for cancer. And generally in every chronic condition now, at least a dietitian will address the diet aspect. Smoking cessation clinics are there, you know, alcohol advice is there, but they're more self-referral, but the diet is looked at.
Finally, in your opinion, how much money could the NHS save each year if nutrition were to play a larger role in treating patients with gastrointestinal illnesses?
Yes, interesting the way you've stated that question. The biggest role nutrition would save is if we could prevent obesity, and the biggest saving would be heart, stroke and liver, not the actual GI system. If you look at each system, yeah? So if the most cost-effective intervention proven in the NHS is smoking cessation. Yeah? I mean, this is data from a few years ago, so I'm not sure if it's changed, but smoking cessation is one of the most effective interventions. Even if you just did it 4 weeks before an operation, for example, you reduce your anesthetic risk. The second biggest intervention for a society is weight loss because of the number of conditions you prevent. So if we can take away obesity, we take away so many problems from the hospital. As I said, it impacts every system. So you'd be saving in every department. But that doesn't help the GI tract, because actually most foods we put in don't damage the stomach or the intestine, but the absorption is what causes the damage. And the major challenge, and we've touched on this at the moment, is we are not picking this up early enough. So by the time most people get to us in the clinic, especially with overweight, they're already so overweight that losing 10 kilos in a year is not easy. But when you have somebody who's 160, 170 kilos, you need a massive intervention, which brings them back down to 120, 130 kilos to prevent the health problems related with that. And if you achieve that, you know, your diabetes risk goes, your liver failure risk goes, your blood pressure risk goes. Even if you develop those things, they start to reverse, and this is all proven. Which is why I think the school role of education and making this a module and demonstrating you're teaching this in schools has a massive gain in society, but that's not, unfortunately, that's not something I can impact. It's for the policy makers. I see the exams my six-year-old does, where at the age of six, he's asked to divide 81 by 9, and I think the question he should have is, which of these five foods is the least healthy for you? And, you know, that's my take on it. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Patel. Okay. It's been really informative and interesting.
No problem.
Thank you so much.